Airplanes, airplanes, airplanes. This is Aviator Cast, episode 14.
Calling all aviators, pilots, and aviation lovers. Welcome to Aviator Cast, where we close the gap between real aviation and flight simulation. Climb aboard, buckle up, and prepare for takeoff. Here's your host, Chris Palmer.
Welcome, 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 aviators. You've landed at Aviator Cast. My name is Chris Palmer. I'm fascinated with this whole aviation thing. I've been a pilot for a good number of years now, although I still find I can't define just how miraculous flight is and how much flying speaks to my soul. I'm the founder and owner of Angle of Attack, a flight simulation training company, which is bringing you this podcast today. Aviator Cast is a weekly podcast where we talk about the spirit of the aviator. We believe flying is an art form, one that we have to continually practice and master. This mastery is gained through a focus on continual learning, human factors, humility, and a commitment to excellence. Each episode of Aviator Cast will have real flight training and flight simulation topics, or an interview with an inspirational and influential aviator. Our desire and mission is not only to create awesome aviators, but also bridge the gap between real aviation and flight simulation. Show notes, transcript, community discussion, and links for this episode can be found by simply going to aviatorcast.com. So thank you for being here on this, the 14th episode of Aviator Cast. It's my absolute pleasure as your host to welcome you to the show. We have a great show for you today, so I'm excited to get right into it. But before we get there, we like to start off with a review from one of you out there in the vast world to review Aviator Cast. So this comes from Linear Groove. He said, "This is great, 5 stars. He's from the United States. I'm a sport pilot finishing up my private pilot. I have thoroughly enjoyed Chris's podcast thus far and look forward to future episodes. The content on the AOA website is outstanding as well. His website has renewed my interest in flight sims. I haven't flown a flight sim in over a decade." Thanks for your review, Linear Groove. Much, much appreciated. And it just goes to show that you can be away from flight simulation for a while, you can come back, and you can still use it as a tool to assist you in doing things like you're doing, which is moving from your sport pilot up to your private pilot. So great to have you, and great to have everyone else listening here on the show. We have a great show lined up for you. Today we are going to be talking with Trevor Bear. Trevor is a friend of mine and has been so for a number of years. Almost the entirety of actually running Angle of Attack. I started Angle of Attack in 2006, and one of the first things I did is I went to a flight simulation conference in the Denver area, which is where Trevor is from, and that is where he and I met. He came to the show, and we struck up a conversation, and it's all been history from there. It's really great to have Trevor on the show. He is another one of those common aviators. Trevor is young like me, and you know he hasn't been around the block too many times, yet he's been in flight simulation for a really long time. He's a private pilot working on his instrument, but he hasn't chose to do aviation as his professional career. So he's one of those, like Matthew in our last episode, that is kind of the common everyday pilot, like most likely like you and I, that are striving to be better pilots, striving to use a simulator to better our safety and overall improve our experience and our expertise as aviators, which at the end of the day is a very worthwhile cause to pursue. So let's get right into it. This is a great and fun conversation with Trevor. Here is Hangar Talk with Trevor Grizz Bear.
Now, a special Hangar Talk segment.
Okay, everybody, we are honored to have a guest on our show today, a longtime friend of mine, Trevor Bear. How are you, Trevor?
Hey, Chris, I'm doing great. Thanks for inviting me to come on the show. I've been a longtime listener and you know, like I said, it's exciting to be part of the show.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure we have a lot to talk about. You know, I had the feeling that this episode is going to be a little more giggly just because we have this relationship where we just laugh about things constantly.
And definitely.
In fact, when we were making the show notes for this show, we decided that your call sign was going to be Grizz. So, you know, we're going to refer to you as Trevor Grizz Bear, which I thought
Grizzly
was,
Bear.
Yeah, which I thought was pretty appropriate.
I feel like my Cessna is deserving of some sort of nose art of a grizzly bear in attack mode or something. But yeah, I'll have to talk to the flight school on that.
We really need to get back into those days. Like, why aren't we putting nose art on all of our airplanes?
I mean, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of history, obviously, and you know, for the history buffs, going back to the nose art days, even World War One, for that matter. I mean, there's tradition there that's not being followed up upon.
No kidding. We need to bring that back.
Yeah, I'll take my markers out to the flight line and see if I can scribble something down and bring it back.
Probably need to keep it G if we want to remain married, but.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Great. Well, it's good to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks.
And I kind of caught up again recently. You know, we've had a little bit of a history together where we've actually worked together before. We've also been friends for, probably going on 10 years now. And you've kind of made a transition to where you were once a simulator pilot only, and now you're aggressively pursuing, flight training, not necessarily for the ultimate goal of becoming a professional pilot, but just because, you know, you got a private pilot because you love it and now you're getting an instrument mm-hmm. because that's a safe thing to do. And so we're going to be talking about a lot of those things today. Before we get into that, one thing and the first thing I always ask our guests here on the show is, when did you first fall in love with aviation? Tell us about your love story.
my love story. Yeah, it's a lengthy love story. I mean, I think what probably started, my universe spinning toward aviation was probably my grandfather. He had a huge impact on my hobbies, my interests. He was into planes and trains and automobiles. And, you know, as I grew up, I picked up each one of those. And, you know, those are still things that I'm interested in. But the planes part is what stuck. And, you know, I remember, I never actually went flying with him. His license lapsed and, you know, he wasn't actively flying when, I was around him as a boy growing up, but just, you know, going into his basement and he had model, airplanes, you know, like World War II spotter plane, little model sitting around and, there's like an airspeed indicator from a World War II fighter and then a piece of bulletproof glass, from the nose of another, fighter. Just being surrounded by those things, I think it kind of quickly became ingrained in me. And like I said, you know, I was doing the planes, the trains and the automobiles things and the airplanes part just stuck. It just resonated. And, you know, that was, oh geez, that was probably when I was 10 years old or so, 1990, and here I am 34 and it's a huge part of my life.
Definitely. And you largely got there too. You know, kind of a way that a lot of the people that come on the show got there is through flight simulation. So flight simulation Absolutely. Is one of these things that keeps that alive. You know, we may not be able to go up in an actual airplane. We may not be actively training, but, you know, as a young teenager and through your teenage years, it's very common, just a very common story for people to have fallen even more in love with aviation through flight simulation. So when did you get started with all that?
So I think, you know, my first flight simulator experience was with Flight Assignment ATP, which was published by SubLogic back in the late 80s, maybe early 90s. I think it was 1990 or so. I picked it up a couple of years after that. I had a friend who also had Microsoft Flight Sim 3. And so, between seeing that at his house and, you know, coming back to my house and getting Flight Assignment ATP, there was a lot of, just being enamored by these software programs that would replicate flight. And it was super cool. I mean, you want to talk about rudimentary graphics. It was 256 colors, maybe, and stick figures. And, external view that still had your panel involved. And I'm sure everyone has seen kind of the early days of Microsoft Flight Simulator. But, you know, there was no, I had no joystick. I had no rudder pedals. I did everything using the keypad on a machine. So, yeah, it was very rudimentary, but that's kind of where it all started. And then from there, I had just about every single Microsoft Flight Simulator product, you know, through FSX, through to the present, and even into the Lockheed Martin prepared. So yeah, it's been a long haul. It's been, you know, what's this, 24 years or so. It's just been awesome to, you know, see how things improve and how the visuals have improved and how the systems have improved. And, you know, you and I have gone down this road with AOA, with just the complexity of things, the PMDG 747, the Level D 767, the MD-11, you know, it's just amazing. And when you try to explain to somebody, you know, I think what they picture is that stick figure, you know, flight simulator from back in the day. And it's just like, no, it's, you know, it's immersive now. It's real. It's just so much fun.
Right. And you get the pilots that have been away from it for 10 years. You know, the last version they saw was FS 2000 or FS 98.
Exactly. Yep.
And they come back and they see what's being done now and they're just totally shocked. It's like, well, wait a minute, what have I been missing, sort of thing?
Yep.
And, you know, that's almost an overwhelming feeling at that point. And they don't necessarily make the transition because then it's like, oh, well, man, I'd have to catch up so far to get back into it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, I've got a good friend here in town who used to fly 757s, you know, for a large international U.S.-based airline who shall remain nameless.
a very large Denver hub, I'm guessing.
Exactly. he's transitioning over to the 737. And so, you know, I brought him over and I showed him the PMDG 737 NGX and, you know, he's just like, this is, you know, this is amazing. Then he texted me the other day and I think I was telling you, Chris, that he's just like, you know, he's going through the training with the 737 sims. He's learning the flows. He's, you know, committing memory items to memory and all those sorts of things. And he's like, your sim seems to have better graphics and better systems than the sims that we're using here in training. It's just, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah, I remember being at Flight Safety in Wichita in their Bonanza simulator. I know it's a little weak, fixed-base Bonanza simulator, but anyway, still, you know, the visuals and the cockpit and stuff, still kind of up to the standards that you would expect from an outfit like Flight Safety. And I just remember I had this instructor that was sitting next to me. He was a native Italian, and some of the time I couldn't understand what the heck he was saying, but it's super cool guy. He was actually one of my favorite instructors while I was there. And I remember I was in Phoenix. No, it wasn't Phoenix. We were doing some procedures out of Teterboro and just some instrument procedures and some scenario based stuff. And I remember him saying, once we got up in the air, he's like, just look at how beautiful the scenery is. It's amazing. You can see the shorelines. I'm thinking, this is crap. Like, there are no buildings, there's no ships in the water. It just, this looks terrible. And this was 5 or 6 years ago now. And now it's even so much better than it was then. But I'm thinking, man, if this is the standard that these guys are working toward, then they really are missing the boat. And, you know, kind of a flip side story to that. I was watching a video from the CEO, one of the founders of Redbird, and he was saying that he actually went through a very similar experience, and this is one of the things that inspired them to kick off Redbird Simulations. Is he and his partner, they went and did a type rating course at Flight Safety, and they realized that the graphics were just completely terrible. It really didn't add well to the situational awareness and the believability of the simulator. And so they walked away from that saying, there's a market here. There's something that we can do. And that was largely, you know, kind of, obviously there are going to be more parts to it, but that's largely part of the reason that they started Redbird, was realizing that there was such a big gap, and it's still there. You know, there's still that separation, and you see it all the time. If you go on YouTube and you look at videos of actual Level D simulators that people are using today, you'll know, especially if you're a flight simulation enthusiast, that the scenery you have in your simulator is so much better than what they're using.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I mean, you mentioned Redbird. I just this week was helping the final assembly with an $80,000 Redbird FMX full motion simulator. You know, I was working with the Redbird rep. We got it local to our airport, and I'm, you know, friends with the guy who runs it, and you know, was helping out, and we fired up. I'm there for the first test flight, sitting in the left seat, you know, getting ready to go, and we take off, and I'm like, this is default scenery. This, you know, right. This is our airport, but this isn't how our airport looks. You know, I've got the scenery that I built for our airport is much better. I should get that to you. And,
right.
You know, so yeah, I mean, it's, even with an $80,000 simulator, my, you know, $1,000 computer that I cobbled together myself and, the add-ons and the display capability, it's, you know, it's a little bit better. So,
yeah. Yep. It's really interesting just how advanced part of the flight simulator community is with the scenery and the add-ons. And it really is this separation in mindset between real aviation and flight simulation. And I don't know if that's a matter of marketing or if it's just a matter of ignorance. But at the end of the day, flight simulation, just the hobbyist market itself, has so much to offer real training applications. It's pretty incredible. It's just something that is only now coming to awareness of a lot of these companies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, just think of where it's going too. You know, with Lockheed Martin being very responsive about, you know, customer concerns when it comes to prepared and, you know, what they're going to be rolling forward and releasing updates and, you know, making it better and better. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, prepared looks pretty promising. All right, so we've been talking a lot about flight simulation. That's kind of the segment we're in now. Mm-hmm. So the other day, this funny thing happened to me, and I mentioned it to you too. So first of all, when we first met, it was when I first had started Angle of Attack, and I attended this conference in Denver, which is where you live currently. Yeah. You had some other places you lived in between, and now I live in Alaska, but I'm temporarily in Hawaii. I guess we're just
we've covered the United States pretty well.
I know, yeah. We got the four corners taken care of.
That's right.
So, you know, we met pretty early on in the process of me doing AOA. So we've kind of been together all the while we've been, I guess, partaking of the best part of what simulation has to offer, because simulation has really come into fruition the last 10 years. It has just become incredibly realistic. Now, one of the funny things, and I admitted this to my wife for the first time the other day, because I just kind of stepped back and realized how funny it was. I had to explain to her what a virtual airline was. And I tell her, okay, there's a bunch of guys. We get together for a specific airline. Say it's Delta Virtual Airlines or United Virtual Airlines or Southwest Virtual Airlines. They take us on as a pilot. We have to gain hours. We have to gain experience. We have to do training. We're active in the community, and we don't get paid for it.
Yeah,
and we study off like crazy to pass our check rides and everything.
Yeah,
and I was thinking to myself, well, man, what am I doing? But you know, at the same time, I'm thinking, and one thing that I told her is, you know, a lot of people can go out there and they can play these first person shooters, which I'm definitely one of those who will do that from time to time. But you know, you can go out and kind of be mindless about playing a video game. But man, if you're going to be involved in video games, you may as well be involved in something like flight simulation, or even to a greater depth and nerdery with virtual airlines, because you actually have to study, and you're studying all these different aspects of science and mathematics and navigation and a bunch of different cool subjects, and actually learning something in the process. So
absolutely, yeah.
So you and I, we used to both be with Delta Virtual Airlines. Are you still hanging around there?
Coming up on 10 years in, I think May 4th or May 5th of this year, it will be 10 years, which is an incredible amount of time for any or internet organization, but I surprised myself that I've been a member of an internet organization for 10 years. It's just, it's pretty surprising. But yeah, I mean, that's a tribute to what you just said. It's incredible fun. It's, you know, if there's listeners who are listening to this podcast and, you know, are just getting bored with flying point A to point B and haven't ever been part of a virtual airline, definitely check it out. I mean, there's ones that cater to all interests, all levels of commitment, mm-hmm. which, you know, Delta Virtual, for example, is great with that. All you have to do is to log into the website, I think once every 60 days or whatever that. So there's, you know, not really even a flying requirement. In fact, you know, I didn't fly at all in 2012 just because I was busy with life and, you know, I still catch up on the forums and see what was going on, but, you know, and then fly when you can. So yeah, it's one of those things that, like you said, you can really expand your skills and, you know, just really become immersed in. I think when I kind of realized, you know, that moment, like you described when you were describing to your wife, what virtual flying was, or fake flying, as my wife calls it. it's just, I guess the moment I realized I was kind of in really deep was when I was quizzing one of my friends who is a real airline pilot about the setup of their navigation display and their, you know, are you using a speed tape or, you know, what's your EFIS look like? You know, how is everything set up? What's your V speeds? You know, what's your flap retraction schedule? So, I mean, these sort of questions, can you imagine if, you know, whatever your day job, say you were a dentist and someone was coming up to you and being like, well, do you use the gold crown on the bicuspid and the lower right hand? You know, it's just like, okay, you know, more power to you. So.
Yeah. I know Nick made a comment like that when I interviewed him. He was saying that he went to his first introductory flight when he was 10 or 11. And as part of their pre-flight, he asked the instructor what VR was for the Cessna they were flying.
Yep.
So pretty funny. So also, just before I forget, you know, virtual airlines are one thing, actually picking out some of these carriers that you would fly if you were going on vacation. But those aren't the only type of groups that are out there flying together. There are groups of backcountry pilots. There are groups of World War II military aviation pilots that go up and do huge group formations with B-17s and actual, you know, recreating bombing runs that were historically accurate. So all sorts of different groups you can join, kind of pick your poison. There's a lot of different things out there. And you know, you get into every type of aviation, anything you can think of, it's out there in virtual aviation as well. So we've talked about some of these things, but how deep does your simulation nerdery really go? Cause I out of all the guys I know, you're one of those that has kind of stayed in it. I wouldn't say that you're in it as deep as some, but you, you've stayed in it for quite a while now.
Yeah. It's again, it's one of those things that you kind of have to, the first step to recovery, I guess, is admitting that you have a problem. So, yeah, you know, I enjoy flight sim and I enjoy it on a detailed level. But on the other hand, you know, I realize that a lot of people are more casual and, you know, into the recreation side of things, and they're not as intense as, you know, either myself when it comes to, I guess, you know, my flight is more procedure oriented, which I think, is probably, more rooted in my background and my profession, you know, in IT and, project management and those sort of things. So, I pay particular attention as, you know, like I was just mentioning, you know, what's your flap retraction schedule? So I try to bug those particular speeds just like they would in the real, you know, airplane, be it a 757 or MD-88 or whatever it is. Try to get immersed as much as I can in the actual, you know, by the book flying. If I were flying this on the line, you know, how would I do things? Now, you know, that said, one of the things that I have never done and don't really have a whole lot of desire to do is to fly, you know, from Atlanta to Dubai or something like that and sit at the computer for however long that is, 12 hours, 13 hours, whatever it is. So most of my flying is short haul flying. And, you know, like I said, that's, I realize that, you know, like you said, it's kind of pick your poison, to each their own. There's all types of flying out there. So, yeah, I'm, you know, thanks to a lot of the add-ons out there, it's it's quite possible to be that immersive and to be that by the book when you fly them. I know when the Aerosoft Airbus X Extended came out, I spent probably, you know, a good couple of days worth of Skype sessions sharing my screen with actually one of our good friends, Chris, Dan Desjardins, who is an Airbus captain for a major Canadian airline. And, you know, just kind of learning the air. I mean, because, you know, all I had prior to that was Boeing logic. So to relearn the Airbus and to have someone who flies it and knows, you know, how things need to be set up and how things are flown, and being able then to do most of those procedures in the Airbus X Extended at that point in time, it was great. I was a kid in a candy store. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. You know, a lot of pilots, they get to, you know, fly maybe a dozen different types in their career. I would guess that's about typical, all the way from their training up until, you know, what they actually fly on the line for the majority of their career. So, you know, they fly maybe a dozen aircraft. When we're talking about simulation, we have this whole different world open to us, because obviously the entry level is just so much different. We can spend $90 on a very, very, very high quality, the top high quality aircraft, and have something that is incredibly, incredibly realistic. And so, you know, it brings this whole new set of knowledge that we can learn from time to time in kind of adding that to our flight bag.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I think the appeal for me and probably for a lot of the people listening to this podcast, you know, like I said, I mean, there's the recreational people who want to control shift one or control shift F1 or F4, you know, and control shift E or whatever it is to start the engine. See, I don't even know what those keystrokes are.
Right.
But, you know, there's those people who want to do that. And that's fine. That's A-okay by me. But, you know, having the ability to get as immersed in the simulation itself has just been it's awesome. It's been a great experience. And to learn that, you know, I don't know how much time I've spent on these. You know, talk about misspent youth, you know, growing up doing these things and, you know, learning V speeds on the MD-88 and then learning the flap retraction schedule on the 757 and then, you know, whatever the airplane is. And now moving into my real world flying, you know, adding more aircraft types. Yeah, it's the challenge is for me a large portion of the fun.
Yeah. And I honestly, I think that's part of why we love aviation anyway, is the challenge that comes with it all. And the variety, you know, the other night, my wife and I, we were cooking just some penne pasta with some homemade sauce. And it was kind of the, you know, I'd kind of taken over the recipe that she had taught me a time or two, and I was doing it on my own. And as I was sitting there preparing this meal for us, you know, I mentioned to her, you know, flying is a lot like cooking, because you have all of these different things you have to continually monitor and change and add and subtract. And, you know, it really is. It's one of these places, and it's been explained by most authors when I read their books or their articles. It's one of these places when we're in a cockpit that we are different there than we are anywhere else. And it's really this, it's not necessarily a different reality, but it's almost a whole way of being. And I think that's why when someone like you, you know, you mentioned this, someone like the last few people we've interviewed, get up in an airplane, you know, it's said that they never come back down, or that was the most expensive flight of their life, right? Yep. Because we realize that this is such an immersive experience, and it's such a momentary experience too. It's in the now. We're not thinking about the past or the future. It's all about the now and this flight and what we're doing. So, you know, that's a big reason why I feel it's enthralling for me and good for my soul. And that goes back to the challenge too that you mentioned, just the challenge of it all.
I mean, I'm not sure if you're like this or if, you know, your listeners are like this, but I found that if I haven't done something on Flight Sim for, you know, a couple of weeks, I haven't found this. My wife has found this, that I start to get a little bit cranky, and, you know, that I want that just kind of that that intellectual stimulation and the challenge, and you know, like you said, there's just so much going on. It's be it real aviation especially, but flight sim as well. Just being able to kind of go down and it sounds weird, but to relax by becoming immersed in something that can be very difficult. Think about flying an ILS full procedure down to minimums or something on your computer. It's therapeutic. It's a fun thing to do.
Definitely. I think business is a lot that way for me, and why I do enjoy what I do with Angle of Attack, because it is so challenging. Now, the difference is that my view is completely different. I'll sit there and I'll work on my computer for 5 or 6 hours a day. Man, I'd rather be in a cockpit, and that's definitely where I'd rather be. It'd be much better. But I don't have all the money in the world to throw at an airplane, so I can't be up there all the time. Okay, so we've talked about flight simulation a lot, and one of the core reasons for this show, one of the core purposes of it, is to prove and to show, not only through interviews but also through just sharing knowledge, that a simulator is infinitely applicable and useful when moving over to a real pilot's license, or using a simulator in conjunction with it, or using it even after you have your training to get better and better. So you've recently made this transition, and before we kind of get into what's been going on with your flight training and how that experience has been, I'm sure it's just been awesome, because that's how it goes for everybody that continues on. How has a simulator specifically helped you throughout this entire process?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. And, that's one of the things. Throughout the Aviator Cast, podcast, there's been lots of times where I've just sat there nodding my head to what your guest was saying and just being like, wow, yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, there is a connection between the simulator world and the flight sim world. Now, it doesn't cover everything, and we can talk about that, later. But for me, I think the biggest part for me has been the ATC side of it. I was active in VATSIM, SATCO, which was the predecessor to VATSIM, even going back to like 1998 or so, was involved with that. So, I had kind of a background of the air traffic control side, applying those principles. And then, of course, flying. I think at the time I started my flight training last year, I had maybe 6,500 or 7,000 hours, most of which have been flown on VATSIM, whenever I can. It's not all on VATSIM, of course, but anytime I can fly on VATSIM, I'm going to. So just being able to talk the talk, if you will, and being able to communicate with air traffic control, for me, that was immediately one of the most recognizable benefits of, the simulator training. Now, in addition to that, knowing the basic flight principles, how to fly various approaches. I think probably all of us who do fly in VATSIM or Pilot Edge or IVAO, any of those organizations, we're pretty much operating in an IFR environment, mm-hmm. Probably 95-98% of the time. So the VFR side of it really was kind of its own beast. But at the same time, if you can talk on the radio and do IFR stuff, you can easily learn how to make position reports on VFR, on a UNICOM or common traffic advisory frequency. So, there was certainly that background of things. And I think, like I said, that's one of the main benefits that I saw to simulator flying, just being able to fly the airplane and being kind of having this awareness, I guess, of how airplanes fly and how airplanes interact with, traffic and airspace and all those sort of things.
Right. Yeah. You definitely get to dabble in each and every area. And, going back to communications, it's something we talked about on the last episode with Matt as well. And he actually mentioned that was one of the things that he learned best with a simulator. And just as with our skills with handling the aircraft and how that is a muscle memory exercise, I find that moving our mouth is a muscle memory exercise as well. And when you learn to communicate well online through, you know, some of these different sources that you mentioned, like VATSIM, Pilot Edge, and IVAO, or I don't know how you say that in an acronym sense, but I'm sure there's some way to say it without it being an acronym. But, you know, with some of these different organizations is it becomes second nature and you don't have to think about your radio call so much. It's more like, okay, well, I'm at this position now. I'm going to key the mic and say this. It's all just kind of done. You don't have to worry about actually getting on the radio. That mic fright is gone. You don't have to worry about that. And one of the things I joked with him about was, heck, us guys on flight sim, we've been doing IFR clearances since we were 13 years old. Like, you know, and you can rattle it off with a ton of other guys waiting at the gate on this huge fly-in that people are doing on VATSIM. And man, it is crowded, it is busy, and we can comply with those directions too. So yeah, communication is big, and honestly, it's fun. One of the things that that I enjoy doing, and maybe you do too, I'll get your take on this, but I actually like having air traffic control all the time. I'm not one of these guys that likes to switch out the radio, you know, not switch out the radio, but squawk 1200, switch to Unicom in the area and just kind of cruise around VFR. I'd rather have flight following. If I had my druthers, I'd rather be actually on an IFR flight plan. Just because it is, you know, it is one of those muscle memory items. I do think that that moving your mouth is one of those muscle memory items. And, you know, from a safety perspective, it puts you in direct contact with someone at all times. You don't have to worry about that aspect. So in just, you know, this is kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but in you flying around, because I know that you've been doing quite a few cross countries, what are you doing as far as flight following and keeping in contact?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely prefer that. And funny, just to jump back to what you're saying about the CRAFT acronym, my first instrument lesson, you know, I'm sitting next to my CFI, we're getting ready to get a clearance, and, you know, he whips out his iPad and the scratch pad portion of it and writes the CRAFT, and he's like, have you ever heard of this? I'm like, I heard of this. I've been doing this for, you know, close to 20 years. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it's funny. And what you say about the muscle memory aspect, it's absolutely correct. You know, I can rattle back a clearance, you know, like it was nothing. You really don't have to think about it. Just write down the important parts. And, you know, same with communicating, same with flight following, same with Class Bravo transition. One of my probably within the first, you know, five or so lessons that I had when I started my private pilot training, we went straight through the Denver Class Bravo airspace. And it was, you know, one of those things where basically my only, you know, direction that I sought from my instructor was, when do I call him? Should I call him now? And he's like, yeah, call him now. So from there on out, you know, it was me talking to him just like I had on my computer for all those years. So, you know, you mentioned flight following and, you know, picking up clearances or, you know, I guess doing that aspect whenever possible. And yeah, I'm absolutely with you on that. It's funny because when I was doing my training, one of the other guys that was kind of along the training, same training path as me, you know, we started about the same time and we had the same instructor and, you know, so I'm doing my long cross country. He's doing his, I did my cross country. I picked up flight following. I, you know, departed from a little airport out on the Eastern Plains in Colorado, you know, pop up to 8,000 feet or whatever and called center and asked for Denver center to give me flight following back to, where the airplane is based. And, you know, I mentioned that to him. He's like, wow, I try to avoid talking to air traffic control. I'm just like, why? You know, we're in an airplane that's 40 years old here, that anything can go wrong at any point in time. I would love to have somebody to talk to. And, you know, it may be for just a few minutes because of the altitude and the reception issues, but yeah, if I can have, and the benefit of that, the side benefit is that you do show up in flight aware, which is awesome for showing your friends. So, so yeah, I mean, it's great to, you know, to be able to use that skill, even in VFR flight. And then, you know, of course in my instrument training, it's been like second nature.
Right. And, you know, you get advisories for traffic.
Yep.
There are a lot of benefits now that we're talking about it that come to mind. So yeah, you know, that's just a small detail that I really like. And, you know, now that you and I are kind of in this area where we're comfortable with communication, which is eventually somewhere that everyone gets, different things can start to happen, right? So you understand the system now, you know how to comply, and so you can start to do some different things. One of the things that I really loved about IFR flying was, this is just kind of just a different detail that you can ask for, is if I was in a particular area, wasn't very busy, and I was right at cloud tops, say I was 500 feet above the cloud tops, cruising at an IFR cruising level, or even 300 feet, I could call up to air traffic control and ask them, can I have a block altitude? And then what I would do is I would descend to, 4,250 feet or whatever it was, and just go right at the cloud tops at sunset. And it's just awesome. But, if you're nervous about speaking to air traffic control and you don't really understand that relationship, I don't feel like that is something that you would necessarily experience, because you wouldn't feel like you could ask, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And that's where, flight simulation and these networks come in, is just that level of comfort, the familiarity with making a call to air traffic control and kind of knowing. I mean, I think a lot of, especially IFR flying, is obviously anticipating what's coming next and, setting your radios in advance, identifying an ILS or a localizer, or sorry, a VOR or something, in advance, but also knowing kind of what to expect from air traffic control. So, you fly and you talk, and I'm sure any veteran pilot, flight simulator or real world will agree that, just kind of knowing the flow of things. And that's mm-hmm. something that virtual air traffic control and flight simulator combined can teach you for pretty much free, right. Which is an excellent value.
And along that same argument with flow, there is a time and place where you shouldn't be on flight following, and you shouldn't have an IFR if it's VFR conditions, mm-hmm. You should be getting out of the hair of air traffic control, ducking under the airspace, and kind of getting out of their way because it's just too busy. So there is a time and a place to do that. And again, it just goes back to that familiarity with flow and working your relationship with the controller, because it is kind of a two-way relationship. You can help them, they can help you, and makes everyone happy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's certainly a two-way thing. And the more opportunity to practice that, and especially the more opportunity to practice that without a Hobbs meter running, on the ground on your home computer, even better.
Definitely, when you're not burning those precious dollars.
That's the thing.
Now,
that's what makes airplanes fly.
Exactly. Let's get into burning those precious dollars now. Yeah. We're going to talk about flight training. So, back in the day when you were visiting me when I lived in Salt Lake, we'd cruise around in the Bonanza at the time. We had a grand old time. I'd come and see you in Denver whenever I was there. But now you're kind of doing it on your own. We always wondered when you were going to go and get your actual license. So tell us a bit about the start of your flight training, what that process is like, maybe mix in. We've already kind of talked about simulation, but how simulation helped you in that sense, if at all. And just tell us what that's been like. And I'm just going to let you go with it. So go all the way up to where you are now with your instrument training as well.
All right. Well, sit back and prepare to listen to my nasally drone go on here for a couple hours. It's just the exposure to flight, jumped at the opportunity to fly with you in the Bonanza, jumped at any opportunity I had leading up to starting my pilot training. And, kind of how things went for me, we talked about where I kind of my first glimpse of flight through flight simulation and kind of where I got hooked, early 90s. About 7-8 years after that, I was able to start my flight training at a small airport in Nebraska. Did as much flying as I could as a high school student, who had to rely on his parents to not only provide funding, but also come and pick me up, for part of that time. And, then had to do school studies in between. So I ended up logging about 10 and a half hours during that period of time. And that actually kind of bridged, my latter part of I think probably my junior year, my senior year, and then into my freshman and sophomore years of college. So it was, like a 4-year span during which time those 10.5 hours accumulated. So was anything retained? Did I get any value out of it? probably not. But what it was, you know, certainly kind of a tie-in to my simulator flying and being able to, you know, practice these real world skills, if you will, you know, even if it's a really infrequent practice, but still getting out there and, you know, getting flight time. So, you know, graduated college, still in love with aviation, still flying flight simulator, you know, started my career, you know, et cetera, kept going, you know, finally kind of fast forward to last year, March, actually about exactly a year ago, March 2013. You know, I had talked with my wife about, you know, I really want to pursue this passion, you know, for aviation. I feel that, you know, if I get to the point in my life where, you know, I'm 70, 80 years old and I have not accomplished this, I think that's going to be one of the regrets of my life is not right. having obtained a pilot's license. So, and you know, you mentioned it before that my goal was never to be a professional pilot, to be, right. You know, involved with the airlines. And, you know, when I was in college, I entertained that idea for about a semester and then kind of reality set in and I dismissed it. So, so yeah, you know, I March 2013, this Groupon comes through for a local independent flight instructor. Thought, you know, why not? Let's jump at it. I've got the money. You know, time, kind of another issue, but we'll make it work. Wife on board, also kind of another issue, but we'll make it work. She was not super thrilled, but you know, anyone. would realize this is what I'm passionate about. So she kind of stood back, which, you know, I credit her immensely.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. You know, just to not outright support, but a quiet support, if you will, you know? Mm. So yeah. So I started flying. I met this flight instructor. He had a 1967 Piper Cherokee PA-28-180, the mighty Cherokee 180. And I've since come to the conclusion that the mighty, portion of the Cherokee 180 name was designated at sea level because at 5,000 feet where I fly, 180 horsepower engine just is, you know, we're cheering if we see 500 feet per minute on departure climb. So, yeah, it was great. You know, I managed to change my work schedule such that I could go and fly afternoons. And so I did a lot of flying in the afternoons in Colorado, which presented its own set of circumstances.
Yeah, no kidding. I was just wondering why you chose that time of day.
That was the only time it was available. You know, having a family, having a job, it, that's, you have to make sacrifices and nearly losing my lunch on every single flight was one of the sacrifices I made.
Yeah, you didn't make it easy on yourself. That's
exactly.
For sure.
Yeah. So, you know, now on out, when I fly in any level of turbulence, it's nothing. So I was really able to kind of acclimate myself to downdrafts and updrafts and turbulence and flying in unstable conditions. So, So I you know, proceeded my flight training. I didn't exactly do it at a brisk pace. You know, I started in March. I flew, you know, two or three times a month, as much as I could. And a lot of our flights were weathered for various reasons. You know, especially in the summertime, we get a lot of high base thunderstorms here in Colorado, which produce downdrafts that, are not at all fun. They, you know, even the mighty Cherokee 180, that's 500 feet per minute climb. this may surprise you, but it cannot outclimb, you know, a 1500 foot per minute descent, from a high base thunderstorm, downdraft. So,
I've seen that before, actually, in the Denver area. I was passing through to the north of the international airport and could see what was going on. And there was a downdraft area the size of DIA, of the entire airport, and it had everything shut down. Just unbelievable. So, you know, and being in Salt Lake, we have similar weather, but it's not as challenging as Denver. Denver is just... It's so notorious for the high winds and the turbulence, and not only that, you know, you throw the density altitude on top of that too, and you have
exactly
a very unique location.
Yeah, I mean, there were times, you know, I kind of chuckle at the 400, 500 feet per minute, but it's justified because, you know, we would depart our local airport, which is just a tad over 5,000 feet elevation here, and you know, listening to the AWOS and it would say density altitude 9,500 or, you know, 8,700 or whatever. It's just like, you know, we might as well be flying up to Leadville and, and, you know, thankfully we're not, because the density altitude there is even worse. But, but yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, an instructor, full fuel and 180 horsepower engine in the Cherokee. And, it would still struggle. I don't know how like a Cherokee 140 or a Cessna 150 or 152. I'm not really sure how that even works out here, but in the summertime, at least.
Yeah. I mean, I trained in a 152, but it was mostly during the winter. So we enjoyed our space shuttle takeoffs and, but it was short lived. Wasn't for real.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all about knowing your limitations and knowing what to expect. And, you know, that was just something we counted on. We're going to have this anemic climb rate. And, you know, if we have to not load up on fuel and, you know, whatever it takes, we'll deal with it. So that's, you know, we kind of talked a little bit about the weather and the flying and that sort of thing. So, you know, my training spanned from March until November of last year. And, at the end part of November, actually the week before Thanksgiving, I had my check ride scheduled, you know, went out, flew with a great DPE. I mean, this guy is awesome. He's very laid back, but fair, but also he knows all there is to know, you know, about flying. He's very wise. And I think that was a great experience. You know, the check ride was something that, I think anybody kind of agonizes about and dreads that day. You know, but, and in fact, you've talked on this podcast about check rides and kind of what goes into it. But, you know, my experience was certainly that as far as stress goes, but just the demeanor of my DPE and, you know, just the casual nature of it was a conversation with someone who, knew a lot about aviation and was there to, you know, just to converse with me. So that made it pretty easy, I would say. I mean, as easy as a check ride can get. So,
right.
Got my license, proceeded to fly as much as I could. And, then an offer from my CFI came along that he would, help me with my instrument training, as well. And, you know, was that in my plan when I first, you know, took my first flight when I got back into aviation last year? Was it in my plan to get an instrument rating? No, but opportunity presented itself. It was a great deal. And, you know, it's something that I recognize could make my flying, you know, even that much better and even that much safer. And that was kind of really the key. You know, I look at the long-term goal of, you know, being a safe pilot. I know it's not realistic right now in my life with a family and with job commitments and, you know, responsibilities to fly, every single day or, you know, every week even, and, you know, fly as much as I want. That's not realistic. So whatever I can do to kind of buttress that and help me to become a safer pilot, you know, I was interested in. So started my instrument rating, started working toward it, I should say, and, have kind of been going through that. I'm at the point now where, just working on finishing up cross country in the last 10 hours or so, of my instrument rating before I take the check ride. So, you know, whether or not that will happen this year or, you know, this month, even, you know, whenever it is, the training itself has been incredibly beneficial in just getting me not only into the system, but, you know, the hood time, the simulator time, you know, flying approaches down to minimums, you know, just being in an environment where it's not blue skies and fair weather cumulus, it's, you know, solid IFR, you know, it's the things that kill people.
Right. And exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, just having that education again, you know, it's something that I think regardless of if you intend to actually get an instrument rating or, you know, wherever you are in your training or your actual holding of a pilot certificate, having that experience and, you know, maybe going to a Redbird sim, for example, and, you know, flying approaches down to minimums and, you know, just getting a look what, you know, good example, mile visibility. We know that's, you know, that's something that's in the FARs, but what does it actually look like?
Right.
And when you're sitting in a sim or the actual plane with a mile visibility, you're like, holy cow, this is not much at all. So, you know, something like that, not only helps your training, but it also helps reaffirm what your personal minimums may be.
Right, exactly. And yeah, I love instrument flying. I think it's one of the pinnacles of what we can do, regardless of how many licenses we add on. You know, if we have an instrument rating, it's always one of those things that will remain challenging, one of those things that we have to remain sharp on. And, you know, I'm actually of the camp that believes that an instrument rating should be required with a private pilot rating. I think that would be absolutely great for aviation safety and you know, a lot of different reasons too.
Yeah, exactly. You know, on this podcast, you've had Paul Craig, the author of The Killing Zone, on, and, you know, I had talked about this before reading that book and just kind of his take on the safety aspects and, you know, what happens when you do have that, that, you know, maybe not an instrument rating, but the ability to not inadvertently fly into IFR conditions and to know what to do to get out of them, you know, the reliance on your instruments and not getting disoriented, that sort of thing. I mean, that's just having that there is certainly a good thing.
Yeah, it's very useful. So what else do you want to cover? Is there anything else you can think of?
Well, you know, one of the parts, I guess if we want to swap flying stories, I had the opportunity a few months back to do a cross country for my instrument rating. It was not, I guess it was not a short cross country. It was definitely a long cross country, and it was a grueling cross country. But what we did was I flew commercially down to Tampa, Florida in, I guess this was early part of February. Flew down on a Thursday night, you know, spent probably close to like 13 or 14 hours in Tampa. And then joined my flight instructor the next day. He flew across. He was actually had taken the plane down to visit some relatives on the east coast of Florida. He came across and picked me up at in Tampa, on the north part of the Tampa area. And we flew across country that consisted of flying from Tampa, Florida to Denver, Colorado in a single day. And it was 17.3 hours of flight time.
Goodness.
Yeah, something more like, you know, I was awake for more than 24 hours, but, you know, was it safe? Was it the best thing, you know, as far as pilot alertness, those sort of things? No. you know, I look at it not really as a cautionary tale, but it was something that we did, and we did everything we could to make it safe. Now, you know, part of my flying was my IFR requirement, so we needed a cross country in there. So that's what we did. You know, we took off from Tampa, and that, you know, the first three stops then became my IFR cross country because we knew we wanted to bang it out early and while we were still sharp and, you know, to get, you know, that portion taken care of. So, you know, we stopped in Florida, we stopped in Georgia, we stopped in Mississippi, and then flew across to Texas and then up to Oklahoma. When we got to Oklahoma, it was about 11 o'clock at night. That entire day I'd had two Red Bulls and a couple Pop-Tarts, as well as a free hot dog and a free waffle in Meridian, Mississippi. If you ever fly into Meridian, Mississippi, let me tell you, they will treat you right at the FBO there with free hot dogs and free waffles. So, but you know, it was entirely IFR the entire way as far as the instruction goes. I was under the hood for the vast majority of it.
Goodness.
And yeah, I mean, it was, there was not much to see. And the weird part is we did not encounter a single cloud that entire 18, 1900 miles, whatever it was. We did not fly through a single piece of IMC.
That's funny.
Which, you know, so much for the training aspect and the act in actual IMC. But, yeah, you know, so we got to Oklahoma at 11 o'clock at night. We stopped to get fuel and realized there was no, 24-hour fuel service there. So we had to, yeah. So, that was certainly, a good learning, opportunity. You know, always check ahead. Don't assume that fuel is going to be available. We didn't even have fuel enough to fly to the nearest airport that did have fuel because it was over an hour away.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where we're sitting there on the ramp. It was maybe 35 degrees, a cold wind. You know, we're kind of huddled there in the airplane for warmth on the phone with the FBO trying to figure out what to do. And, you know, we're like, well, do we just call it a night? Is that, you know, is that good enough? I'm like, I'm hopped up on Red Bulls now, so I'm still good to fly. So, so we got our fuel and we got going. And, I think one of the other, you know, that was one lesson to be made. The other lesson then was, the ADM aspect, the aeronautical decision making, because right. we were coming up from Oklahoma to, Erie Airport, which is on the north, it's on the northwest side of the Denver International Airport. It's kind of on the north part of the metro area. You know, coming up on an instrument flight plan, it's nighttime, western Kansas, eastern Colorado, there's no lights whatsoever. I mean, there's maybe a light per square mile and then some town scattered out. So, I mean, you want to talk about it, might as well be IMC.
Right.
That's one of them. So, yeah, you know, and then you get to a point where you're talking to Denver Center, all of a sudden they start to get kind of sketchy and you can't really hear every word of their transmission. Then you lose them completely.
Right.
And you're like, I'm alone. You know, if the engine were to quit, I guess we try to find a road. I think that might be a road. You know, the good thing about flying in this particular part of the country is you stand a pretty good chance of hitting, you know, either a cow or a windmill than a tree. You know,
right,
if you have
totally.
To land out on the plane. Yeah. So, you know, I know my fellow pilots in parts of, you know, like Tennessee or the East Coast, it's not as good of a prospect for setting down off airport, but out here, at least there was that. But, anyhow, the ADM side of things, you know, we were coming toward Denver. It was coming up on, you know, probably 1 o'clock in the morning. We're looking at our fuel. We're looking at our headwind, which by that point had pushed us down to about 78 knots or so across the ground, which, when you're like, well, I can just about drive my car as fast as I'm going right now. That's where you really start to kind of wonder what you're doing, you know, 4,000 feet above the ground in western Kansas at, you know, midnight. So, but you know, we pushed on, my instructor was, thinking we could make it all the way. My thought was, let's not chance it. You know, let's set it down, you know, somewhere prior to the Denver area, because we don't know what air traffic control is going to do. You know, maybe we'll get routed around the Class Bravo or, you know, south of it or something. So we kind of had, you know, a back and forth dialogue on, you know, what should we do? Should we keep pressing on or divert or what? So, you know, eventually I kind of stated to him that, you know, I'm not comfortable continuing until, you know, all the way to our final destination. I'm not comfortable with that. Let's stop at either this airport or this airport. And, right. you know, yeah, we talked about it. It's like, yeah, I think you're right. You know, so it's one of those things where get there itis was kind of creeping in,
right,
but at the
totally.
Same time, yeah. And especially in those situations, you know, it's late at night, you're vulnerable, you're probably not at your sharpest. You know, it's one of those things where you just kind of have to assert yourself and trust your gut. And so we stopped at Front Range Airport, which was on that side of the international airport. And, I don't know, we put in like 35 gallons, 36 gallons or something like that, 33, enough that it would have been, you know, we would have made it to our destination, but we would not have been legal. And there was not, you know, the ability to be, encounter anything and deal with it. So yeah, it was a great thing we stopped. You know, like I said, it was one of those things where you kind of have to assert yourself. And, you know, even though my instructor has, you know, thousands of hours, it's one of those, you know, let's collaboratively make this decision that will be, you know, the best possible, the best, or the most opportunity to have a safe outcome.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, this goes directly to the core of what we talk about or have been talking about a lot on the show, which is scenario-based training. You know,
yep.
you can go up all day in the Denver area and you can do approach after approach. You can do holding patterns. You can, you know, follow navigation courses, whatever it is, instrument proficiency sort of things, right? But that is not what counts at the end of the day. And applying that to a private pilot as well, you know, you can go up and you can do your ground reference maneuvers all day long. But what scenario-based training is teaching all of us, and it, you know, it's something that's been here all along, but it's becoming more a part of the core of training, is there's so much to be learned in the actual decisions that go into a flight. So
exactly.
One thing that I've always contested actually is, you know, we're out here training. Yes, we have to pass these certain practical standards and you need to learn these certain skills as a pilot, whatever license you're trying to learn, but let's go somewhere and learn something along the way. And so I'm really glad that, you know, I kind of asked that final question because this is the perfect experience and you may have grown more during this process than any of the other hours that you spent during your instrument mm-hmm. training, because you actually saw that these are real things that happen and you kind of knew anyway, right? We all know because we read the stories, but it makes it real. It makes it personal to you that yes, there is get there-itis. Yes, it's night and I'm over Kansas. Is this really smart? I'm not necessarily telling you that it wasn't smart, but all of these different things that go into this process. And that is what pilots become. When you become a pilot, you know, you're not going to go out, you're not going to do ground reference maneuvers. You're not going to go out and just do instrument approaches. You're going to be taking your family. You're going to be taking your friends. You'll be flying yourself and you're going to be going from point A to point B, and you're going to have to manage the decisions and the processes, and you'll have to tell yourself to stop as well if things just aren't working out. So, you know, that was an incredibly valuable experience. And it would be great if training was more like that. If we had instructors that wanted to head out and go somewhere and do something. And you know, we're seeing that with the implementation of the FITS program and things like that in the flight schools. But this scenario-based stuff is great.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that flight itself, you know, I realized we were playing with the deck somewhat stacked against us. And, you know, my CFI realized that too. It's, you know, it's 1 a.m. after 16 or 15 hours of flying and, you know, a dark night, but it's the weather conditions at least are clear. You know, our mental state, it was one of those things where, you know, like you said, it's just, you have to realize kind of what you're getting into. And, you know, I realized this isn't potentially unsafe situation. It was not unsafe at that point.
Right.
You know, but we cross-check each other. And that was the thing. After you've been flying for that long, okay, you know, fuel pump on. Okay, you check the fuel pump now. Okay, it's on. I'll double check the fuel pump, you know, that sort of thing. So
there were
times when we, you know, said to each other, okay, I'm going to make this radio call. You make sure I, you know, set the heading. So, you know, essentially what we did was employ kind of the CRM aspects of airline flying of, mm-hmm. you know, a dual crew, of, you know, the challenge and response, or, you know, double check what altitude I'm at, or, you know, that sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, just having that sort of, you know, it's not the number of hours you fly, it's the quality of those hours. And I think, you know, getting into that and certainly flight simulation and personal minimums and all those sort of things that you can explore with flight simulation, you know, maybe for those guys flying Atlanta to Dubai and staying up all that time, maybe they also get that aspect of being completely exhausted and running only on Red Bull fumes. But
I think it's pretty common.
I think so, which is, you know, that's what's great about the community.
You explained that and I, you know, it sounded exactly like the pilot diet I know.
Yep.
Just run on.
It's not exactly healthy, but.
Yeah, you run on trail mix, Pop-Tarts, and 100 low lead. That's how it goes.
That's right. Absolutely.
Well, it was great having you on the show. Really enjoyed our conversation. And I'd love to have you back too. You know, next time we have you back, we'll dive into a subject together and kind of break something else down now that everyone knows you a bit better. But good luck with your instrument training. I'm sure it'll be a blast and you'll be rocking and rolling there in the bumpy, unstable air in the Denver area.
Yeah, that's what we get here. Yeah, I mean, I certainly appreciate it. And I hope your listeners found something of value in our conversation. You know, I would definitely invite everybody to check out my website, trevorbaier.com, TrevorBaier.com. It's kind of just getting up, but I like to put my flying videos out there. And I've done a few flying videos for Microsoft Flight Simulator as well. So, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, my interest in aviation, my photography, my flights, you know, my training, all that. So yeah, thanks for having me on, Chris. It's always great to talk to you, and certainly appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks for being here, Trevor.
You bet. Thanks.
Yep, see ya. It's really great to catch up with an old friend in Trevor and learn about his experience of becoming a real aviator and learning more about his history as a flight simmer. So one of the interesting things that happens to all of us is we never truly ask these questions about our peers. We never ask, how did you fall in love with flying? Or, you know, what was your experience like when you got your private pilot? Or what is your flight simulation experience like? It's one of those questions where we just kind of, not necessarily avoid it, but, you know, it's just one of those things we take for granted. And one thing that I find as we go through these great conversations with people like Trevor is that we learn that we have a lot in common, that we came from very common backgrounds and desires and a passion for aviation. So thank you, Trevor, so much for being on the show. This was a really great Hangar Talk episode, and I can't wait to have you back on the show so we can talk more about what you're learning and what you're going through, and also break down some great topics for the audience here. And I know on behalf of the audience, I can thank you for them as well. And again, we'd love to have you back on the show sometime soon. We'd love to hear your thoughts about AviatorCast. You can truly shape this show and the topics we provide. Take a quick 2-minute survey at survey.aviatorcast.com. Maybe you want to be a part of the AviatorCast community or leave a comment. You can simply do this by going to aviatorcast.com to join in on the conversation, or write me directly at me@aviatorcast.com. Suppose that you don't want to miss an episode of AviatorCast. No worries, we've made it really simple for you. You can subscribe through email at aviatorcast.com. You can also go to iTunes, which is probably the preferred method if you are an iTunes user. And also, you can subscribe through Stitcher, YouTube, or SoundCloud. We're a lot of different places, and you can find AviatorCast all over. We'd love to get an honest review from you on iTunes. This really helps others learn about AviatorCast so they can enjoy it as well. And it's one of our main sources for marketing AviatorCast to get the word out. You know, we don't really ask for anything here. We just want to share with you great, great information, information that we feel will be incredibly useful for other aviators out there trying to improve and trying to be safer in all that they do. And that's why I bring in some of these interviews with people like Trevor and people like Bruce Williams and Paul Craig and Matthew Rosener and Swain Martin. We've had a lot of great interviews so far. And, you know, these people are of the same mindset, and that's why they come on this show for free. They come on here because they want to help you become a better aviator. So if you could, leave a review if you like this show, and we'd really love to hear from you. If you'd like to check out any of our trading products here at Angle of Attack, head to flyaoamedia.com. Start with the basics for free with Aviator 90. Learn instrument flying and more with Aviator Pro. Or even fly many of the world's most popular jets virtually with our training products for the 737, 747, 777, and MD-11. Again, at flyaoamedia.com. Last but certainly not least, many thanks go out to the Angle of Attack crew for all they do to make these episodes possible and all they do outside of AviatorCast as well. They allow you and I to have a lot of fun each week going over some of these great topics and interviewing great people. And last, this is truly last, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of AviatorCast. It wouldn't be possible without you, and I really enjoy interacting with you and getting your feedback on the show and learning that it is making an impact in your flying life. We are truly grateful to have you here, part of our community, and so engaged in this wonderful passion for flying things. Until next time. throttle on.
10-5-8 is ready. 10-5-8 is the short line. Turn left heading 235. Maintain 2000. Runway 25 right. Clear for takeoff.
Clear for takeoff. 25 right. United 580.
Aviator cast. Are you going to do that? Do that part.
Do that. I like that part. Do that
That's
part.
Right. It's the best part.
No, that I do that afterward.
Yeah.
In fact, the other day I was listening to, I had put together one of the episodes. I don't remember if it was Paul's or Bruce's, but I was listening back to it and I started the beginning where it's like, this is Aviator cast episode, blah, blah, blah. And then the catchphrase, my wife was sitting there and I just stopped it. She's like, what? You don't want me to listen to it? I'm like, no, it's for my internet friends only.
You do not exist in that universe, okay?
Exactly.
You cannot cross the streams. Just be like, airplane, airplane, airplane.
That would be a good one, man.
There you go. You can just do variations on that.
Airplane,
400 episodes on that.
I might do that this episode. That's funny.
There you go. Awesome. Cool. All right. Well.